Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us at Reform to Freedom Ministries, where we share stories of those who have triumphed over challenges beyond the prison bars. Hear credible testimonies from prison advocates, social activists, and legal experts which can bring impeachment. Join us each Thursday at noon for the latest.
And good afternoon, and welcome to Reform to Freedom Ministries. And this is your host, Diane Winbush, and thank you so much for joining in with us on today. And so what we're going to be discussing is the conversation is going to be in regards to prison reform, police reform, and prison transition. And so today we have three guests that will be offering their expertise as well as their opinions on these topics. And so we would like to welcome to the show former NYC New York, New York City police officer turned law professor Charlene Brown. Our second guest is prison reform advocate Laura Wetzel. And our last guest for today is the CEO and president of Times for Homes, and that is James Ryan. So thank everyone for being taken out of your busy schedule to be a guest on the show today. And so welcome. So we're going to get right into the topic. So we're going to start with Professor Brown and for her to share a little bit about her expertise, what she does on a daily basis in her field. And then we'll get into discussing about what prison reform is all about.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. And again, thank you for having me to discuss this fortunately but unfortunately very timely and relevant topic. As was mentioned, my name is Charlene Brown, and for 26 years I was a member of the New York City Police Department, and I rose through the ranks to through police officers, sergeant, detective, lieutenant, captain, and deputy inspector. I was one of the first African-American women captains to be selected for the NYPD. While I was a police officer, I also attended law school and became an attorney. During that time, I devoted my practice toward consulting and was a Fulbright Fellow, where I studied police diversity in London and also trained officers in racial profiling issues. I've also had experience working on various consent decrees, both locally and abroad. And most recently, I am a member of the faculty of Berklee College, where I am a professor in criminal justice and law. It's my pleasure to be here.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much for being with us. So if we have Laura on the line, you can go ahead and share with the audience a little bit about you. Okay. So we'll move to Mr. Ryan, if he's on the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Okay.
So I represent an organization called Time for Homes, which is an organization that believes adequate housing is a human right, and we advocate for an inclusive housing first philosophy, providing public housing, trauma-informed supportive resources, and advocating for a holistic systemic change to how we approach homeless policy. And that's where we get into some of these other issues, such as you're addressing today.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for being our guest as well. So, Professor Brown, we want to start with you sharing a little bit about what prison, well, I'll say, we'll say we know what prison reform is. So we're going to start with defunding, because there is a lot of concerns, and sometimes individuals actually don't have the correct definition as to what defunding the police department is, and so we would like for you to open up and share with the audience as to what they are trying to do and how beneficial will that be, or will that be a risk for them to defund the law enforcement?
Certainly. So I think, to put it in the most simplest of terms, defunding the police means actually reallocating or redistributing funds that go into policing budgets and moving some of those funds away to other agencies that can provide services that are well needed in the community. Services for housing, services for employment and education and the like. I think underneath that general definition, I think different people have different perspectives on what the funding additionally means. And for some, I think that word, the funding, has been a little bit charged, because the funding means sort of to take away and to strip away. And for some people, it's a dismantling. And during these times, people are looking for accountability from the police. So the idea of actually taking power away and sort of ensuring additional accountability through the divestiture of funds is something that some people are in favor of because of the loss of trust that some people would say have with the communities. So on the one hand, you have people who are in favor of a complete dismantling of policing and to not replace it with any system of law enforcement at all. And on the other hand, you have a school of thought that says, let's look at all of the duties, functions, and responsibilities of policing, and let's try to take away and alleviate some of the burden of police departments and working on issues of homelessness and addiction and things that police officers have to encounter, mental illness, that maybe could be better handled by social service organizations, and allow the police to actually function on their role, which is enforcing laws and working on crimes and violent crimes and assisting the public in that way. So in between that, I think there's a myriad of that perspectives of opinions. But again, the most simplest definition is the removing of funds from a local police department and redistributing that money towards the community and community services.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay. Ryan, Mr. Ryan, how would that be beneficial? So take, for instance, if you're helping those that are trying to get back on their feet, you know, I say transition a home or what have you, and so you're trying to help those that are homeless to get back on their feet, to be able to be operable on their own. How would those dollars, those extra dollars, be beneficial and supportive to your organization?
Sure. So to take it back a little bit, we all want safe communities, right? So this reallocation of funding from the police isn't necessarily saying that we don't like the police or that they don't do a good job. It's that it's not the most efficient, effective way of doing all the tasks we've sort of assigned to them because no one else is stepping up to do it. It's just, it was easy to allocate the funding and then we didn't really care about efficiency or effectiveness. So by reallocating those funding to community-based organizations like Time for Homes or any number of others, you're actually making substantial change in those communities by reinvesting that money with people that can actually do what you're asking them to do without necessarily like criminalizing poverty, for example. Like we see all over the place, this sort of hostile architecture, right, that the city is spending money to implement to keep people from being able to literally just sleep in public. By reassigning those funds to organizations that have the capacity to use, you know, trauma-informed care, building a case management approach for each individual they serve, and really looking at the causes of what's bringing them to that point and how to best reintegrate them as a productive member of society, whether that's getting them adequate health care for mental health issues, something like that, helping them get into stable housing, job training, whatever. You often can do much more for less funds than simply arresting them and locking them up.
I absolutely agree with your concept, and even with that, according to, now this is coming from a news article from CNN, and this is going to be also towards, this question is also for you, James, and it's in regards to one of the correspondents, Josh Campbell, had interviewed one of the city councils. I think she was the president of the city council of Minneapolis. And so we know that that area has had a lot of backlash on some issues with the police department, you know, rioting and protesting and what have you. So here is what the president of the city council of Minneapolis stated. Says their police department is not making their communities feel safe and seeking alternatives rather than to find rather than to fund the policemen. So she was saying in retrospective that it need to be put towards issues like more resources for the EMT, community-based strategies, mental health services, and also to the fire services. So take, for example, if this was your organization and you were attending this meeting that she has put out towards the media, how would that be effective for you to be able to approach that? Because that would be something that I would attend. You know, if I'm trying to get more individuals to support me as to what I'm doing, trying to help individuals to be more positive towards my nonprofit, because that's a big thing. Homelessness can be a bad light, especially when you're having major events that are going on. Because I know in Memphis, Tennessee, they try to go in there and try to clean up all the homeless before they have Elvis Week, before they have, I think it's another one that they have, the Baptist Convention here. They'll try to go in and try to clean all of that up. So if this was you as the president of your organization, how would that be? How would you approach that as an individual trying to get funds? Still, we're still talking about funds, but this is her trying to say that it, you know, is more beneficial for EMT. I think it's also beneficial for transitional homes as well.
Correct. So the data shows historically that a model called Housing First works. People basically are given access to housing, whether that's permanent affordable housing or transitional housing, depending on their particular need level, and is more cost effective, right? So what we can say in this instance is, rather than taking X number of dollars, whatever percentage of the pie that the police department would use towards enforcing these ordinances, rounding them up, and then either shipping them off, which happens all too often, or incarcerating them, which happens also very frequently, and reinvest those, literally just putting them in housing, right? There's already quite a few social services out there to help with opioid addiction or job training, et cetera. But the problem is many people can't avail themselves of it. For example, if you need to take a medication, you know, once a day at a specific time or a couple times a day at specific times, and you don't have a house, you might also lack the access to water, safe storage space for it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So literally just getting them into some sort of permanent shelter, make sure the downstream effects are easily handled. There's a number of projects that have shown this kind of time and time and time again. One of the more recent ones in Hawaii, where they actually used Medicare Medicaid funding for this using an 1115 waiver. Going back to that medical thing, you know, you and I might go to CVS or Walgreens and pick up some drugs and go home and rest and recover. If you don't have that opportunity, what do? You end up going to the ER. So we're already overburdening the systems that we do have. So by reallocating the funding from the police, from those sorts of punitive services to help these people get off the streets and into something, we're even helping, you know, you mentioned that the EMTs, for example, were looking for a larger slice of the pie. Well, if we're not overtaxing those resources that already exist, the ambulances, the ERs, et cetera, their dollar goes further. So this is one area where it's a pretty easy change, a humane solution that is effective just kind of across the board.
Okay, great. So Professor Brown, so a lot of times local jails, institutions, private institutions, they will, you know, apply for grants. And so I think that's what a lot of us have thought that police funding was in aspect to that as well. So a lot of times when individuals are applying for grants, local jails, sheriff departments, private institutions, they will have to have enough offenders incarcerated, or, you know, because now the prison system now is like a hotel. You know, you have certain amounts of money that it costs per night or per bed or per prisoner or what have you. So, and I think that's some of the outcry as to why the protesters are thinking that defunding and taking that away. You know, they're thinking that if you are locking me up simply because of the fact that it's going to make a better meal ticket for you, or it's going to make you get this grant or what have you, or this is going to make you get billions of dollars where you can be able to practice more resources with the security level or what have you. And I think that's an outrage, and people are not actually addressing it. That's the reason why we're doing this podcast, is to address this issue. And sometimes we protest, but we don't have all the facts. And I think it's very important for us to do the research first before we step out and do, you know, and I'm not against protesting. If the voice needs to be heard, it needs to be heard. So my question is in regards to that, as to, is that a part of funding the police department when local sheriffs, local jails, local institutions reach out to the government for help and assistance, like for body cams or for maybe a project that they're working on at the facility?
So, yes, I think you're bringing up a really, really great point. And, you know, internationally, the United States spends more on punitive spending than it does on social spending. And it looks like police departments are broken. And one of the reasons why it looks like they're broken is because there are years and years of policies that have been laid on top of each other that have allowed police departments and society as a whole to say if someone does something bad, the response is to punish them. So we started with crime in the 70s, and then the crack epidemic in the 90s, and then the militarization of policing after September 11th, giving a large equipment to them. And all of these policies are laid over each other that have now allowed organizations to think that way. However, if we look back to see what the community and what the public and what the protesters are looking for, they are saying, hey, if you invest in strong social structures and social communities, if we have better education, if we have better housing, if we have better employment opportunities, then we would have less crime committed, therefore less need for the police to arrest, less need for the prosecutors to prosecute, and then less need for corrections to house inmates and facilities and provide treatment earlier on. So I think one of the reasons why these organizations are seeking the funding is because of the way society is looking at how the criminalization of certain behaviors that result in addiction and other factors. So I'm saying that we all need to come together to the table, members of the community, mm-hmm. members of law enforcement and housing and other social structures, to sit down to think about how should we first restructure our laws and policies. And then once we come to a consensus that we shouldn't always punish everyone for their demons, we can come to a better solution that would result at the end in lower incarceration rates and lower crime and better opportunities in communities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. James, would you like to come in on that?
Yeah, echoing the professor's statement, to bring it back to the grants and whatnot you were looking at earlier, the way we approach law enforcement, by looking at numbers of those incarcerated or for district attorney's offices, numbers of convictions, whether or not they're plea deals or whatnot, really gives us the wrong thing. I will hold up NYPD as a CompStat program as what could have been really great, right? By looking not at necessarily the convictions, but looking at trends within neighborhoods of what crimes are happening, what's being reported and whatnot, and seeing if the approach is effective by those numbers rather than strictly saying, okay, well, we have, you know, 40,000 inmates in our penal system in this one area. That's not really the best way of going about doing it. And it stems back, as you mentioned, the whole war on crime and like crack epidemic becoming the war on poverty, and it ended up being rather a war on impoverished people. Mm-hmm. And that's really where we need to look at how we're addressing this entirely. You mentioned that communities weren't feeling safe with the police department that they had. The whole point of the police department is to make communities safer. So I think we really need a fundamental shift in how we look at this. And those particular numbers and the grants you mentioned are really part and parcel to that. You had the federal government for a long time promoting these policies that individual police departments didn't necessarily want to do, but it's how they were able to get the funding that they wanted for other things, right? Carrot and stick. You tie one policy that they may not like with something that they do want, and thus you got it. And that, you know, really just a continuation of really the systemic racism in the country, right? From the sort of the new Jim Crow, if you will.
Okay. So back to you, Professor Brown. Let's go back to James. You know, a lot of times when prisoners are, and I'm going to come back to you, Professor Brown, a lot of times when prisoners are incarcerated, okay, and so they have programs on the inside of the institution to be able to help them to be able to get their GED. They can become some of them can become attorneys too. They have all types of programs for them where they can get certificates and degrees. But my thing about prison reform, I feel, is getting to the meat of the prisoner, not trying to give them programs where they can perhaps may or may not be able to utilize that certificate once they get on the outside, unless it's a second chance ministry program or what have you. So I had an opportunity to work with and for the U.S. Marshals several years ago, and so I would always ask them, what would you do? Where would you go? Would your community be better for you to return back to, you know? And so by you having this home that can be able to help so many, what type of programs do you implement there with your brand that you have for those that are homeless or whether they've just come out of incarceration and may not have to have anywhere to stay? Because that's the point about prison reform. A lot of times people feel that it's organizations that are just going in, you know, I'm going to read the Bible to you, I'm going to give you lesson plans and things like that. I feel that prison reform, you have to get to the person's actual issue. If I am a serial rapist, I need counseling on how to reduce my emotions as to how I approach other people, you know? So if you would just respond to that, if you would.
Sure. So you mentioned a number of programs that are available in many prisons already, the GED, different certification programs, you know, through schools. There's a couple of problems with that. One is when you get out, right, you're looking for work. Most places mm-hmm. ask, do you have a felony conviction? There's some areas now where they have these, you know, check the box campaigns, remove the box, like Chicago's working on getting to make that not allowed, right? So you mm-hmm. already have this sort of second class citizenry, right? You come out, you have this felony, you're branded for life with this. So how do you get over that? And that's where organizations like some of our service providing partners will actually work on entrepreneurial training, right? So big problem in the cycle that brings people into prison is poverty and the lack of ability to build generational wealth and really just continuing to be exploited time and time again. So what we found as effective that people are doing in communities is teaching people how to do that, giving them mm-hmm. Grants or microloans to actually enable them to do so. The GED programs that exist are great when they're available. The problem is that they're often not. We also have a unfortunate tendency to release people that to an untenable situation, right? Okay, mm-hmm. here's your 5 cents an hour through your incarceration. You've probably spent all of it on hygiene items. So you leave, you might have $50. How are you getting a house at that point? And if you don't have a stable address, your parole or extended supervision or whatnot can be revoked. So it's really a matter of making sure that all of those resources are there and that people that are being released know what those resources are. And unfortunately, getting into the prison from an organizational perspective isn't always the easiest. It's a little bit too easy to get into prison the other way, though. So the social workers that do exist in the prisons really do need to be held to account to look at the organizations and services that are provided in the community of origin and where the prisoners are being released to try to facilitate and make those connections. You know, if you're incarcerated, you don't have access to the internet and whatnot to look these things up. And unfortunately, organizations mostly don't have the ability to get into the prison to share that. So there is a disconnect between what is offered and what is available. And I would say that if we're looking at prison reform in general, we need to really have a critical eye on the reentry process.
Absolutely. And I'm going to let you touch on that a little bit also, Professor Brown, but I'm going to make a statement right in between there. You know, I think it was the governor of Mississippi. He turned down and refused the bill to be able to help offenders, you know, with prison reform. And so, if I'm not mistaken, Mississippi is the poorest state in the union with the United States. And so I kind of had a problem with that. I'm like, you know, you need to be trying to find ways to be able to build your communities better. And I think that would have helped them just a little bit if he would have perhaps maybe would have passed that. So you can go ahead, Professor Brown, and comment on what James had just stated.
I'm also like to comment on something that you just stated, which is why anytime I have a forum to speak, I urge any listener to stay as involved as you can in your local and civil politics, because your local and civil politics have more influence on your life than even right now we're in a presidential election cycle than perhaps that, because most budgets for corrections and policing are really funded on a local level. And so to hold your governors accountable and hold your mayors accountable, it's important to stay active, to stay engaged, to vote, and to vote on local levels and be aware of those local issues. And so I think there's definitely a need to also look at policing and realize that we have the organization and structure, and right now we're focusing on the bad officers, but there are some leaders and some agencies that are taking a seat at the table and helping to try to reform and reimagine policing, like the commissioner in Philadelphia and the captain that's in charge of the National Association of Black Police Officers. And I think it takes work for everyone to sit at the table and to again come to a consensus about what we really want as a society, because is it really prison reform to work with people that are incarcerated in the system and then release them to nothing, and to release them to only $50, and to not give them an opportunity to engage and re-enter in the pipeline to make to become citizens of society when they've left families and families are broken and fractured? And so those conversations need to happen, and there needs to be additional work to be done. And that's why I always advocate for having everybody come to the table, because police, prosecutors, corrections, social service agencies, we all have to come together and decide what our role is and what our stake is at that. And there are so many different divergent opinions that we're not all on the same page about what we really want. And what we really want is to have meaningful communities. And if we have meaningful communities that have less crime, then that's a less burden on the taxpayers.
Absolutely, because that was the primary thought that I had after watching the news story of the I think it was like a breaking news story here in Tennessee, and so we are able to pick up channels as well with the state of Mississippi, and so I thought that was kind of disturbing. I think it's a new governor, and so I thought that was kind of disturbing to refuse prison reform, because that would be easier on the taxpayers, and that would also, you know, be able to help programs on the inside of the institution to prepare them, because if they're going back to their same community, of course they're going to be coming back into the system pretty soon if they have not been rehabilitated, you know, behind prison bars. So, you know, that was just my take on that. I thought that that was kind of a little harsh on his part with that. So this question is going to be for this is going to go back to James. So talk to us a little bit about some of the programs, at least a couple, I want to say, of what Time for Homes offer for those that are perhaps maybe transitioning to make a better life or a lifestyle for themselves. It's not actually just prison or offenders or what have you. It can be individuals that may, you know, say, hey, look, I'm tired of sleeping in the alley. I want to do something better with my life. And then what are some of the strategies that you're using to be able to compel them to be able to enroll, you know, as perhaps as an individual that would like to participate with your program?
Sure. So as far as getting people involved in taking advantage of the services, our service providing partners have a number of different ways. Between the drop-in centers where, you know, you can look up online or call 211 in need of support, and street outreach teams, which literally just kind of drive around in a van and look for people that are sleeping rough or whatnot, and approaching them and starting to build a relationship with them, telling them what services are available, how to, you know, avail themselves of it. The biggest problem there, though, in any of this, especially for people that have been homeless for some time, is building up that trust, because often the sort of authorities seem sort of bent on that punitive measure, or maybe offer services and then the follow through isn't always there, unfortunately, in some instances. So it's building up the relationship, kind of getting them to understand that, hey, we are here for you. That's what all of us are doing, and then getting them into, you know, family resettlement and support services, getting people back from homelessness, really integrated into the community, offering medical clinics. You know, chronic health conditions are a really big contributing factor if someone ends up homeless, and obviously homelessness itself, sleeping rough, can contribute to physical and mental health issues or diseases. So it's really just a kind of complex system of building out an individual treatment plan in each case, and seeing all of whatever resources are available, whether that's the job placements or the training or the counseling, the 12-step programs or mental health clinics, support getting medications and whatnot, and really integrating that in a holistic approach for each individual, rather than trying to get, hey, this is what it is. This is, you know, the line for the shelter. This is the line for the soup kitchen. And while shelters and soup kitchens are important, really helping them navigate through is what the key is, for the individual success with the person or their family. But combining all of that with kind of, as the professor mentioned, most of the governing happens on a local or a state level, but keeping the pressure on the municipal government and the state government to actually ensure adequate funding is available, and that the overall policy of the community or of the state is aligned in such a way as to reduce the amount of overall homelessness. It's much easier to keep someone in a home than it is to get them from the street and put them into one. And that's, you know, kind of a big fight we're having right now, in context of the global pandemic and the wave of evictions coming up.
Okay. So, and this is back to Professor Brown. You know, it's a criminal defense attorney, and I know everybody knows him, Joy Jackson. He's, you know, on CNN, and I think he provides, I guess, his expertise for Fox News, as well as there's an echo somewhere on one of you all's phones. it was Fox News, MSNBC, and, you know, he's been around for quite some time. So anyway, he posted this video in regards to the new release of this video about the gentleman that was shot in the back seven times. So my take on that was it's an overkill with the justice system somehow. And you didn't hear of this stuff years ago. You didn't hear of people, you know, I think one of the, this gentleman was trying to just put a pin in that one, what I was talking about Joey. But it was an individual here in Tennessee. He was trying to provide for his children. Even though it was fraud, it was like $12,000 in teen care fraud. And so that's fraud, $12,000 in teen care. They're trying to offer this man 29 years. And so my question to you, Professor Brown, is why is it such an overkill on sentencing, dragging the individuals into, you know, it's like it's almost impossible for individuals that don't have a job to be able to maintain, you know, some things focused. You know, I know we're supposed to know right from wrong, but as I responded on Joey's page on Facebook yesterday, Joey Jackson, you know, I think that we're losing control simply because of the fact that there is a lack of training. It seems like it's a lack of training in law enforcement, or is that the training is either watered down, or is that the people are feeling that the law enforcement now feels like it's us against them, or it's to the point where, you know, I'm not listening, or either the hierarchies that are over these police departments are not enforcing them to take down, defuse, because, okay, take for instance, let me explain this right quick before you answer the question. If a person decides to protest, that's their First Amendment right. But if they protest and everything is peaceful, why is it that the law enforcement have to come out there with riot gears and batons and all of these other resources that they have or tools that they have to show a sign of aggression? I feel, you know, now unless it's finna get nightfall, then I need to pull out the shield. But if it's not nightfall and they are doing a peaceful protest, I feel that that's an act of aggression from the law enforcement's perspective as to how they approach individuals that are trying to exercise their First Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm. So this is some good stuff. You should invite me back and we do a podcast just on that one question. your one questions. But so I think to start off with, I just kind of wanted to say, you know, technology has assisted in police accountability. And, you know, starting in the 60s when we had the television and we were able to see what was happening to protesters. Then we moved on to the internet and social media, and it allowed people to be able to connect and individually share stories without having to go through structures. And now we just have the power of a cell phone where someone can just capture video, and in moments the world can really see what's happening, because prior to that, it was basically sort of one word against another. So I think that has begun to open the eyes to people about incidents on the one hand, but also on the other hand, you know, if you're watching a video from afar, you're not getting the entire vantage point and you don't see everything and you don't have the benefit of all of the facts. And, you know, sometimes you can see something one way and it could be something else. You mentioned laws and, you know, why, you know, you mentioned about the new Jim Crow and the systemic racism, and, you know, we have a lot of policies and practices and systems in place, but it's when those policies and practices are not applied fairly and evenly amongst communities, we start to see those inequities, because, you know, people in more affluent communities have drug problems too, but they're not arrested because their families are sending them away to expensive drug treatment programs. But in other communities where they don't have that resource, they call on the social structures of government, and that allows people to now enter the system and be subjected to the unfair application of laws and rules. When it comes to police and the police practices, you have one of the challenges in the United States is there's over 18,000 law enforcement agencies, and there's no one entity to regulate them. And the average police department has about 20 police officers.
So different agencies have different levels of sophistication in dealing with issues. For some small city, if something like this happens, they've never seen it before, and even if they did have the training, they don't mm-hmm. have the proper resources to react, number one. Number two, we need to think about, I think James had alluded to it in his opening comments, not everyone wants to abolish the police completely. People do see a role and a need for police. But if there's mm-hmm. a need for the police, we need responsible, socially conscious, aware people that have courageous leadership that will step in and help drive the reform that's needed in mm-hmm. these agencies. And that means when you're now in the face and you see a video, to not ignore it and not say anything, because that does more than erode the public trust. So mm-hmm. so we need responsible people to step in and step up, to take the role to be police officers, to lead as police chiefs and lieutenants and captains all the way through the system, that are going to be willing to understand the importance that it means to have strong community relations and trust. There's a need for different types of training, because you can train all you want, but sometimes if you have poor judgment, you can't train people that lack judgment skills. And so it's really mm-hmm. about identifying people that have the ability and the capacity to work in crisis and engage in crisis management skills. Each incident has different circumstances. Each incident had different officers with different level of experience. They just released the name of the officer in the Jacob Blake case, and he's a 7-year veteran. So so there's so many different factors, and each officer mm-hmm. should be dealt with and addressed differently, and the agencies need to have after-action reports. I was watching something on TV, and someone came up with a great idea that I ascribe to, similar to a plane crash, when you have the NTSB come in and step in and have an after-action to critique mm-hmm. issues and then figure out how to reinstitute those changes in your department, in your agency, in your training. Right now, because tensions are so high, mm-hmm. police agencies, some of them are feeling on the defensive, and so now the rash response is, we're going to send it outside someplace else for another investigation, and then we're not going to say anything. And that does nothing but erode trust. So, but to make that change, you need courageous leaders, you need support from the communities, and you need people that are going to really step in and take their oath of office seriously to be an officer, because what's worse than being a bad officer is to be a good officer in a bad agency. And what we need to do is work and support the good officers to help turn around the broken structures of some of these departments.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a powerful statement. So I'm going to let you comment on that, James, in just a second. So just be thinking about, about your response on that. And so I would like to also make a notation as well as to the fact that the NYPD, okay, we already got the COVID going on. It was going on. It's still going on now. Okay, and so there were many, I think it was around the time, I'm not for sure if the park was opened up and they had turned it into some type of cemetery or what have you in New York. So with that being said, so why did the police department, several of them, I think the news report said it was like 19 of them had just walked off their jobs and quit simply because of the fact that they made the outcry of defunding the police department. See, now, because some individuals, everybody has their own opinion, and some people, make opinions and it may not be true. So it was a comment that was also stated that, they're walking out because they don't want anyone to challenge their theory as to how they practice justice. And I think it may have been between the Rayshard Brooks issue, how he was fatally wounded and things like that, and that's a whole different story. And also with the George Floyd, I think it was right in between both of them when I think it was like 19 police officers had walked out of the NYPD. So some felt that, maybe they have walked out simply because of the fact, they don't want anyone to challenge their techniques as to how they practice law, what have you, and things. I feel that my concept to police departments is that they need to have an active counselor on site where people can be able to go, they can have access where they can go if they're having problems, because the issue with the George Floyd situation, the guy was, you know, going through a divorce, okay? And so people make rational judgments out of their adrenaline that they're already going through personal problems. And so do I blame that officer? I can't say I blame him. I cannot even blame the other guys that was in the Rayshard Brooks issue simply because they were trying to talk down the victim in that, you know, and just like you stated, sometimes you can see a video and you can only see parts of it. So I want to see we want you to respond on that first, Professor Brown, and then we'll let James respond on that and whatever the other topic that we had just discussed. But because sometimes we can make rational judgment, I think that was, you know, I know the police department probably felt the, you know, I'm not valued enough, or they don't think that they can trust me as a police officer, but I don't think that that's what they were saying. I don't think that they were trying to eliminate their jobs. It's just the protesters may have escalated the issue in between those two incidents, between the George Floyd incident and the Rayshard Brooks incident.
Yes, certainly. And having managed and been involved in many protests myself, I can attest to how stressful it is to not only work and manage the differing perspectives in the protest, but then sort of taking away that feeling when people are spitting at you and calling you names. It's easy for any human to internalize. So a number of departments in NYPD does have and offer counseling. And there's a new program somewhere that the New Orleans police is also offering in partnership with a local university as well. Mm-hmm. The challenge, though, in a profession like policing is that officers may not feel comfortable to step out and ask for that help, because if the persona that you're putting out as a law enforcement officer is a protector, that's a hard Teflon a mask that you wear. And so it's very difficult to want to step in and say, I need help. And so that's, again, the challenge that goes with the culture change, to allow someone to say, you know, it's okay that you need help, and it's okay to come forward, and to come forward without stigma, and to come forward without any judgment, so we can give you the support that you need. It's like a basketball or football team when it's a timeout and they all go in the locker room, because sometimes you just need a break to come back out. But there's a need for a culture shift to work with all officers to let them know that they can avail themselves to the resources that some departments do have. And sometimes that's very challenging to get people to do that. Even, you know, if you're dealing with people battling with addiction and all sorts of other things, it's hard for people to acknowledge that they need the help when they know they're under pressure. And, you know, suicide rates in law enforcement is high, but people sometimes aren't seeking the resources that are available to them, which again causes a challenge. Is a challenge, and then causes a threat then to the public safety of the public when this person's all wound up, and then they're dealing with these issues, and then they step into a stressful situation.
Absolutely. I think sometimes all of us have been on that tightrope before, where we react before we actually think a situation over, or an incident, or before we thoroughly process an issue and what have you. And like I said, I'm kind of in between on both of the issues, but I do agree as to what you're saying. Sometimes when we have these videos, which we call it in journalism, we call it citizen journalists. And so sometimes individuals, the media is also another challenge, because sometimes when the media is trying to reach their clout, they're not going to show the whole entire thing. They're going to show just only the part that's going to beef up the, you know, escalate the audience and what have you, and things, because they're just like entertainment as well. And so it was just, I was just kind of concerned about that because, you know, if you're going to walk out of something and things like that, first of all, eat the whole pie first before you think about just eating just a piece of it. Get the whole understanding as to why the individuals feel that, and I guess some of the officers felt that they was going to lose their jobs or they was going to lay off a lot of police officers and what have you and things like that. And I'm not for sure if I've even heard that statement as of yet. I mean, it could have been in the media, but I have not heard that statement as of yet. So sometimes I feel that people perhaps maybe make rational judgment and just maybe need to take a step back and perhaps maybe review everything. But thank you for clearing that up, that some departments do have on-site counseling, and sometimes it may be challenging for people to, I guess, humble themselves to admit that they perhaps maybe have, you know, maybe a personal issue. So thank you so much for that. So, James, it's your turn. You're welcome to jump in.
I think Professor Brown hit it right on the head about people not being, or police members not being willing to take advantage of some of the resources that are available to them. And you mentioned the sort of us versus them mentality and the need for a cultural shift. I think that's very accurate. There's a lot of talk about the demilitarization of police and that over time the equipment has been increase and they have basically the equivalent of tanks and whatnot. But I think a other aspect of that that we didn't really touch on too much is that the people being hired to become police officers are often, you know, military vets fresh out of a war zone, and we're not taking the time to really retrain them a bit. And we have these sort of war on drugs, the war on crime, etc. And the rhetoric we're using reinforces that. And it makes them feel that they might need to be that little bit more macho and whatnot. So we need to look at who we're hiring and what that process is that they're going through to be screened rather than just a physical, making sure that the psychological evaluations are sufficient and maybe ongoing to try to address some of that potential for like PTSD development over time based on the trauma that they see and that they experience on the job. And I think a important part of that would be an empowered citizens police review board that a lot of locations have, but not all. I think they need to be a little bit more powerful, have subpoena power, and actually hold the police accountable to their communities rather than the police only holding their communities to account. I think that needs to go both ways, and then brings back to the original thing about just being involved in your local government. Learning about who's running, what their positions are, voting, and keeping, you know, in touch with them, letting them know that, hey, these are issues we're concerned about. Because it's not just, you know, defunding the police and making them lose their jobs. It's really about what aspects we have the police do, who become police officers, and really making sure that they're integrated with the community. There are other things that we need to do as far as reform overall, prison reform, criminal justice reform, such as eliminating mandatory minimum sentencing, reducing the use of cash bail, and making sure that public defenders are fully funded and can provide an adequate level of care to their clients.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So we have covered a lot on this topic on today in regards to defunding law enforcement. Also with transitional homes, we talked about times for homes with CEO James Ryan. Law professor Charlene Brown has given a lot to us, because a lot of times we grab the wrong handle of the stick, and sometimes as James had stated, you know, attending these local, you know, local city council, and then too you know, voting is very, very important. And so I would like to make one last point here in our state, in the state of Tennessee. The governor just passed a bill with lawmakers making it a Class E felon for protesters to be able to protest on the property of the state capitol here in Tennessee, where I guess things may, I don't know if it may come up damaged or what have you, but their voting rights will be taken away. And they will be incarcerated up to 6 years. And so, you know, I have some concerns. You know, I know people should not loot. That's not a part of protesting. They should not vandalize. That's not a part of protesting. Protesting is making sure that your voice is being heard. But at the same time, I also have some issues as to what was just passed. And, you know, they're trying to blame Antifa on all of these other protests that are going on around the nation and what have you and things. But I just felt that that was just a little bit too harsh to go in there and apply those types of restrictions on individuals. Basically, they're telling them you can't say anything. If you do say something and you say it on this property, we're going to arrest you and you're going to be locked up for 6 years. And I'm just trying to figure out how systems can be able to write harsh and penal laws like that and attach them to crimes. I mean, you know, that's going to be a total different show and a total different segment. We're just about out of time.
Well, and if I can interject, there's a difference between protesting and riots. And hopefully that law, if passed, will be challenged and will be found to be unconstitutional, because people have a constitutional right to speak their voice.
Mm-hmm.
What I think people don't want is the rioting and the looting.
Okay.
You know, there's some arguments about
mm-hmm.
why that's happening.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And people, you know, that have built businesses, of course, you know, they want their property to be protected, and that's totally understandable. I just thought that the governor should have came up with a little bit of a better solution than to put those types of harsh stipulations. Sometimes you have to come off the bench and out of the office and get down on the pavement with your people to hear what they are trying to convey, because some people have a different way of communicating, and sometimes individuals feel that this is the only way that you're going to hear me unless I shout it out to you. You're going to ignore me if I don't say anything else, but if I shout it out to you and walk the streets, we're not talking about looting and rioting, but we're just talking about walking the streets. If we do that, then that's the only way that I can be able to get your attention. That is totally severe, because it should not be to a point where a person should have to walk that many times. They're still protesting around the United States, you know, and they should not have to continue to walk constantly about the same thing over and over and over. And I think that's the reason why the gentleman, John Lewis, if I'm not mistaken, that's the reason why he kind of kept that little frown a little bit on his face for, you know, a lot of times, especially when he would be in the congressional seat. He would always kind of be, you know, serious all the time. He meant business, and it is wrong as to how some things are playing out as we see it today. But, of course, without the rioting and looting, because that's something that I do not agree with. So we only have about 3 minutes left. I would like to start with James, and he could be able to tell the audience how they can be able to connect with him, how to follow him, and follow his program.
Hey, thank you much for having me today. If people are interested in seeing how that they can support their communities in ending homelessness and working on the problems associated with it, they're welcome to find us at timeforhomes.org. That's the word time, the numeral four, homes.org, or at social media at time, numeral four, homes. Not on social media. We are always open to conversation with people if they have questions on how they can get involved in their communities. They can look at our website that says how they can get involved, as far as who to reach out to, what they can maybe talk to their government representatives about, and find some partners of ours in their local communities that they can maybe volunteer directly with.
Okay, great. Okay, Professor Brown. Okay, Professor Brown, do you hear me?
Hello, can you hear me now?
Okay, yes, go ahead.
I can be reached on Instagram at LegalNista, and I also have a Facebook group called Living While Black, Blue, and Pink. Please join that group. We engage in topical discussions, and we post articles and have a conversation about some of the issues that we were discussing today.
Okay. Okay, great. So I would like to thank both of you for taking the opportunity to be with us and to be able to share the expertise on both sides of the fence in regards to defunding law enforcement as well as prison reform. We talked about police reform. We talked about counseling for police officers. We talked about protest and rioting. We talked about governments. We talked about judicial systems. And these topics are very, very important because I think that it's better for a person to get understanding first before they react. And when you have all of the knowledge, you can be able to approach a situation a little bit better. That way that I won't host a protest without me having all the facts first. And so sometimes when individuals may protest, which that is their right, and once the media approaches them as to their objectives, as to why they are marching, sometimes individuals will be seen stumbling over their objective as to their purpose of being out there to protest. So that's the reason why we don't want to, you know, go in and misconfuse law enforcement, judicial systems, or what have you, as to how they should be running this or how they should be handling that. You get all of the information, you get the knowledge, resources, and tools and understanding first. And hopefully the listeners were able to be able to obtain a lot from you both on today. So again, I say thank you for being our guest. And so everyone, you can find us at www.reformtofreedomministries.org. This is Diane Winbush. Until next time, you take care. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.